Welcome to Talking Biotech, the podcast dedicated to exploring the latest advancements in biotechnology, sponsored by Calabra, the R&D software that accelerates scientific discovery with AI. Each week, we'll dive into the latest innovations and discoveries with industry leaders and pioneers. Now, here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
It's the Talking Biotech Podcast. Goodbye, your communication. It's the Talking Biotech Podcast. Well, ain't that fun? Yeah, well, this is the Talking Biotech Podcast, and thanks for joining me again. It's another week of talking about science and biotechnology. And thank you to Calabra for sponsoring us. And things are changing a little bit. I hope you've enjoyed some of the video versions of this. And we have some excellent stuff, as they say, in the can. Materials that are recorded. Material that has been recorded. And is really, really nice. Some really cool technologies that are just blowing me away. So good stuff. Now today, I'm putting up a interview with Dr. Felicia Wu, and this is her second time on the podcast. And I look forward to any time I can sit down and talk to Dr. Wu, because she is a brilliant food scientist and risk analyst who understands the real risks of food security and food safety and all the goodies that we normally talk about. The problem is that I met her for dinner, and we're going to do the podcast, and I brought a microphone, and we're in a restaurant where it's a little bit loud, and the music overhead was like, was good, but it was going to be a problem to do the interview with a recognized scholar with Olivia Newton-John physical in the background. So we packed up the stuff, and I said, well, she's staying at a hotel, so we'll just do it there in the lobby, because hotel lobbies are typically nice and quiet, and it's a good place where you can find a little corner and sit down with somebody and have a conversation, right? Well, it turns out that we went to the hotel lobby, and it was quite loud. And the worst part was is that we were near the door, which is a giant, like a gigantic, like 3/4 inch or an inch thick, a tempered glass door that would open and close, and it sounded like a door on Star Wars, like. And then a lot of people were there, and they were having a good time, and everyone getting together, whatever it was. It was a lot of very, very busy lobby, and because of that, my microphone seemed to pick up the noise better than the signal, unfortunately. But I listened to this carefully. And I debated, do we make this part of the series or no? And I think that we do. So I apologize for the fact that sometimes you're trying to pull something out of the mud. I tried to audio engineer this as best as I could. But Dr. Wu is so good. And I really enjoy talking to her. I just think she brings so much to the table across such a spectrum of questions. We'll talk about risk and, what is the difference between hazard and risk, and how does that apply to things like aspartame and glyphosate? And we covered just so much ground. For every bit that you are listening and you go, this is horrible, I can't believe he did this, there's a part that is just brilliant from her. and we just had a good conversation, and I enjoyed it so much that I want to make it part of the archive. If you can't stand it and it's just absolutely horrible and you can't do it, I'm sorry. Next ones will be better. Sometimes you do these things on the fly and you capture what you can get. And sometimes the words are too important to just let it go because of the quality of the recording. So I will go ahead and turn this over right here. And how about that intro music? Yeah, it kind of works. Okay, thank you very much for listening. And here we go with Dr. Felicia Wu.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's Talking Biotech Podcast by Calabra. Today we're going to be speaking with someone we've spoken to before, and we're going to cover some important areas that border on the areas more of, I guess it's kind of psychology almost when we talk about risk, right?
The psychology of risk, yes.
Yeah, very cool. So we're speaking with Dr. Felicia Wu. She's a John Hannah Distinguished Professor and the University Distinguished Professor in the Food Science and Human Nutrition and Agricultural Food and Resource Economics Departments at Michigan State University in lovely East Lansing, Michigan. So welcome to the podcast again.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Falter. It's great to have a chance to talk with you again.
Well, thank you. It's nice to see you again, and glad we were able to do this. So we're doing this live. I'm going to make sure I didn't pull out any wires here. Yeah, so we're doing this live, and we're just kind of sitting down having a conversation, and we thought, let's get out the microphone and talk about risk. So you have a background in risk and risk assessment, and it's a topic that I find more and more interesting all the time, especially as we approach news items, and especially as we look at controversial topics. So what is risk?
So the way that we typically think about risk, something that you all have the chance to know about, is everyday risks that you might encounter in life. For example, if you drive a car, what is the risk that I might get into some sort of bad traffic, or worse, some sort of road accident? You might think about risk in terms of the foods that you eat. If I eat this, is this going to increase my risk of, say, type 2 diabetes, or increase my risk of cardiovascular disease? You might think about risks in terms of activities that you might like to do, like downhill skiing or activities like that, and think, well, even though I love doing this particular activity, it comes with a particular risk, and how do I weigh that risk in my mind compared with the benefit of the enjoyment of doing the activity? Those are some of the ways that we think about risk. The way that I like to think about risk conceptually, and we typically do in the field of risk analysis, is that in order for there to be a risk to you, there has to be a magnitude of harm as well as a probability of occurrence. If you don't have both the magnitude of harm and a probability of occurrence, then you don't have any risk. But if you have both, then you can begin to talk about risk analysis and risk assessment.
Oh, that's neat. So I've paid attention to this area. I've never really heard it framed that way, but it makes perfect sense. Magnitude of harm and probability of
occurrence.
Okay, so I've always heard risk is hazard times exposure.
That's another way to think about it. Yes, that's right.
So what's the difference between a hazard and a risk?
So that's a great question. The hazard, I would say, based on the way that I had originally framed it, is the magnitude part of the risk equation. Hazard says, well, is there the possibility that this particular activity or this particular chemical, this particular bacteria, this particular etc., that it could cause harm? What hazard is missing is any notion of probability or of exposure. So hazard may say this particular chemical could cause cancer, but it doesn't answer the question for you, are you being exposed to this particular chemical, or how much of the chemical do you have to be exposed to before your risk of cancer really does meaningfully go up?
Yeah, so it's kind of like getting behind the wheel of a car is a hazard.
Yes.
Because you could encounter an accident.
Right.
But if you drive in the middle of the night, no other cars on the road, and you're awake and completely, got your stuff together, not so much risk. But if you're in heavy traffic, maybe sleepy or whatever, now you're opening up to increased risk.
Yes.
Because that hazard really stays the same.
That's exactly right, Kevin.
Okay.
So one way to think about it is that driving is a potential hazard. Of course, we don't always think of it that way. Otherwise, we might find it difficult to get out and get into our cars every single day. Driving is a hazard, but there is no risk to you of driving-related accidents if you don't drive. You could, for example, if you biked, yes, there's the possibility that you could run into a road accident there, but it won't be because you were driving yourself.
Okay, so in the area of food science, because you talked about food quite a bit, what is the biggest realistic risk that we run into in food science?
The biggest risk. That's a very difficult question to answer, Kevin. And I think that we can think of it in two different ways. There are particular food contaminants that are of extremely high concern. That's one way that we think about food, and we usually answer that kind of question in food safety risk assessment. For example, if we're assessing the risk of aflatoxin, which is a toxin that's produced by fungi in certain crops, especially corn and peanuts and other nuts. Or one that many of you have probably heard of, salmonella, and its quote-unquote friends among the pathogenic bacteria such as E. coli, 0157H7, Campylobacter, Listeria, norovirus. Oh, that's a virus, not a bacterium. Those are some of the food safety risks. Now, when we talk about food science and human nutrition, we also think about the risks of particular diets. And what I teach my students at Michigan State University is that when you're calculating what we call the relative risk is all about, well, if you follow this particular diet, for example, then that might increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. And that would be if your relative risk is greater than one. On the other hand, if your relative risk is less than one, then what it might mean is that you're following a diet that's actually beneficial for your health. For example, the table that I give to my students on the very first day of class is a study that's done by Orlick et al. In 2013, comparing different types of diets, a vegan diet, vegetarian, semi-vegetarian, and an omnivorous diet, and looking at whether they result in any changes in terms of diseases and mortality over the course of 6 years for about 100,000 people who followed these diseases in Loma Linda, California. And the results were really interesting because they calculated relative risks. And what they found was that the relative risk for men consuming a vegan diet was significantly below one, and the 95% confidence intervals were also, 95% confidence intervals were also all below one, which seems to indicate that a vegan diet, for example, is typically very good for especially the cardiovascular health of men, but the same result was not true for women.
Huh, it's very interesting. So it's not just a question of risk being different from person to person. The thing that always intrigues me is the perception of risk, especially with respect to major news stories and major news media. So why is it that human beings have such a skewed sense of risk?
So that's an interesting question, Kevin. I don't know enough about public perceptions in general to say that humans have a skewed perception of risk. I think that sometimes we have particular biases that make us look at certain activities, for example, as being more or less risky than they actually are. For example, if we talk about different types of decision-making heuristics in behavioral economics, like anchoring and adjustment. Mm-hmm. So one example that, again, I give in my class is I play a bit of a trick on them, and I tell them that I'm going to play the trick ahead of time, but they don't know what it is. So then I ask my class, I'll ask one particular person, for example, "Hello, Lauren, what do you think the risk of there being rain tomorrow is? Do you think it's about 30%? And then she might give an answer like, "Yeah, it's about 30%. Or she might say, "Oh, I don't know if it's 30%. It might be closer to 25% or 40%. And then I'll go to another person. I'll say, "Now, John, what do you think the probability is of it raining tomorrow? Do you think it's about 80%? And John might say, "Oh, yeah, it's about 80%. Or maybe not, but maybe it's more like 75%. The whole idea behind that heuristic is that if you give them a number, and I'm completely pulling the number out of nowhere, either 30% or 75% or 80%, then they tend to anchor on that made-up probability and then adjust only very slightly around it. And that is a risk and decision-making heuristic that can throw us off.
Yeah, I totally get that. I mean, it works like a charm, too. I mean, attorneys use it all the time. There's so many good examples of anchoring and how you could use that and use it in negotiations all the time. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm kind of curious about, what always bothers me, is I'll have people who will have no problem getting in a car, driving like a maniac, and they have no problem doing it. But at the same time, say they don't want aspartame in their soda because that's a risk. And so they are very concerned about something that we know is a risk, because we can measure the fatalities in automobile wrecks. We know that certain behaviors are dangerous on the road. Yet we've never shown any good data that show a legitimate health risk from dietary exposure, normal dietary exposure of aspartame. So why is it that people feel that chemistry is killing them when it's really things they do that are worse?
Yeah, that's a great question, Calvin. Oftentimes in our minds, we don't necessarily compare the relative risks of different agents and activities in our lives. So I can tell you, for example, Kevin, that I've never thought about the risk of a food additive in comparison to how well I drive and what the probability is that I might end up in an accident, for example. We don't tend to make those kinds of comparisons. I suppose we compartmentalize in our minds. But I'm glad you brought up the example of aspartame, Kevin, because as you may know, I serve on what's called the Joint Expert Committee on Food Additives of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and the World Health Organization. It's, our abbreviation is JECFA. And we did an evaluation last summer at the World Health Organization of the risk of aspartame to humans, whether or not it causes any, for example, human cancer risk or risk of other diseases such as type 2 diabetes. And this was a bit of an interesting example because we, JECFA, did the risk assessment, and another branch of WHO called IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, did a hazard assessment of aspartame. And when WHO, we did our assessments 3 weeks apart from each other, one in the office, IARC did that, and then we did our assessment in Geneva, Switzerland. And then after our assessment, WHO shared a press release, and the New York Times, BBC, a lot of other news outlets basically described our assessments of aspartame, and they never quite got the story to a level that people understood. So my friends and colleagues who knew that I was doing this risk assessment of aspartame would read the New York Times article and say, well, Felicia, I don't really understand what that was all about, so can I have some aspartame or not? So then I tried to explain it to them. Maybe I should go into a bit of description about what aspartame is.
Oh, yeah, you can go ahead. What is? Well, I'll tell you a funny story about this, too.
Please do.
About the same time of the IARC decision, I used aspartame as an example in something I did in a public talk, and a woman afterwards was very angry and came up to me and said, you don't know anything about aspartame.
Oh, dear.
So there you go. Tell me about what it is.
I'm sorry.
Find it.
Right by you.
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that, Kevin, and that's a really interesting example. Aspartame is an artificial sweetener, or is sometimes called a non-nutritive sweetener or a non-sugar sweetener. So it was evaluated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and some other agencies around the world in the 1970s, and it became pretty common in American diets in the 1980s. So you might know aspartame by some other names like NutraSweet or Equal. Aspartame being an artificial sweetener is, the way that we express it is that pound for pound or ounce for ounce, it is 200 times sweeter than table sugar. So you need only a very small amount of aspartame in, say, diet soda or in those packets of Equal, for example, or to be used in, say, multivitamins, like the chewy multivitamin gummies, if you're wondering what is causing the sweet flavor without adding a lot of extra calories. Oftentimes it is aspartame. So it's in a lot of our different foodstuffs. And JECFA, this organization of which I am now a member, first evaluated the safety of aspartame in 1981, and they based it on a study that was also published in 1981 that showed that rodents that were administered as high a dose as 4,000 milligrams for every kilogram of their body weight had no adverse effects. And so just to be ultra precautionary, because in that particular study, they actually never found a dose that caused any harmful effects. JECFA then divided by 2 factors of 10, or a composite factor of 100 for safety, and said the safe human dose is 40 milligrams per kilogram body weight per day. Now, if I just tell you that number, yeah, that's a safe dose of aspartame for you, for example, to my friend Joe or to my friend Bert, they'd still say, huh, what on earth is that supposed to mean? But when I tell them, Well, what that means is that you can drink between 14 to 20 cans of diet soda every day for the rest of your life, and it's not going to cause any appreciable human health risks. Then they say, oh, okay, now you finally put it in terms that makes sense to me. Since there is some potential risk, but I'd have to, the exposure would have to be so high I'd never come close to it, then for me personally, there isn't much of a risk at all with aspartame.
Yeah, so that aspartame is a great example because this molecule has been highly vilified by different groups online. You hear it cause controversy and people taking precautionary steps, don't give it to their kids, this kind of thing. But really, it could be, if used properly, a good alternative to sugar, which we know has health consequences. So when we talk about relative risk of aspartame versus sugar, there are people I know who say, well, I want the more natural solution. I want sugar over aspartame. Really skewing the risk the other way.
Exactly, because there have been many other organizations that, basically international research organizations that have linked sugar consumption to a variety of different adverse health effects, ranging from type 2 diabetes and other metabolic diseases, to various cancers, to increased cardiovascular disease risk. So it really is a matter of, we really do need to compare the risks. If you're not using aspartame, what would you be using in its place? Now, of course, there are a variety of other artificial sweeteners, and of course, there's plain table sugar. So it's a question of, you know, if we take this one off the table, so to speak, then what is the alternative?
Oh, very good. Well, we're speaking with Dr. Felicia Wu. She's a distinguished professor squared at Michigan State University. And we're speaking about risk and getting risk right, of the steal of Jeffrey Cabot's book. And we're going to be back with the other half of the Talking Biotech podcast, Mike Labra, in just a few minutes. Now we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast. We're speaking with Dr. Felicia Wu. She is a distinguished...
This episode is brought to you by Calabra, the data monitoring platform designed to reveal research insights and streamline reporting across your organization. With Calabra, you'll gain a comprehensive view of your research workflows, simplifying scientific IP governance, compliance, and analysis. Visit Calabra.app to learn how you can transform your research process today. Calabra.app.
Professor in several different ways. John Hughes, distinguished professor, or John Hannah, distinguished professor. John Hughes, distinguished professor, I don't know who that is, and university distinguished professor at Michigan State University. And we're talking about risk and understanding risk and applying it to different scenarios that we commonly are encountering. But one of the places where we hear a lot about risk, because it's all over our Facebook feed, it's all over the television stations, is what's going on with glyphosate. We've had a lot of conversations about glyphosate here on the podcast over the years, but why is it that people feel such a huge amount of risk relative to what science has described as a relatively innocuous chemical?
I think it's because in the case of glyphosate, as with many, many other chemicals, what we often hear about in the news is the potential hazard. We know that this particular chemical, if consumed or exposed to at extremely high levels, could cause harmful effects. But we oftentimes we're reacting to knowing about a hazard, but we don't necessarily think about the probability or the exposure part of the risk equation, which is, well, how much of this chemical do I need to be exposed to before I'm likely to experience any harmful health effects? Or, you know, is it possible that the amounts that I'm exposed to would never result in a harmful health effect? And I think that that has been the case for glyphosate and for some other chemicals. We don't really know what, so to speak, a safe dose is, which is something that we do talk a lot about in risk analysis.
Yeah, it's a really important point because you can show that when you administer huge amounts to a petri dish, that you have some sort of negative effects. You also have that from Windex, from table sugar, from distilled water. You know, cells in a dish are a sensitive system, and they're going to respond to just about anything you do. You look at them funny, they do something. But this is where we have such a skewed perception, because when we look at animal reports, like one that came out a couple of years ago, really beautiful work run by a group at Arizona State University, where they fed mice 500 milligrams per kilogram a day, which for me would be 50 aspirin tablet-sized pills of glyphosate per day for 14 days, and then noted that you could detect it in the brain, just crossing the blood-brain barrier, and it was causing some biomarkers of inflammation. 100% great stuff. Good work. When you then take this work and show this to the university communications people who like to really sensationalize and get the most out of the story, they say, now we have this chemical linked to Alzheimer's disease. And that's exactly what happened. And then social media takes it from there. So how much risk is coming strictly because of misplaced understanding of what risk really is, and how maybe can we become better communicators to that risk?
I think that's a really important question, Kevin, and it is not by any means easy, because it's very, very difficult to communicate science, and especially consensus reports. And here's where I will invoke IARC again. Again, IARC, or IARC, stands for the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And they are the health organization that does hazard assessments for glyphosate, aspartame, and about 1,000 other chemicals, viruses, bacteria, radioactivity, etc. Many, many different things, and even activities like night shift. Yes.
Salami.
Yes, exactly. And I can give you now, Kevin's audience, a very brief overview for how IARC does their hazard assessment. They look at three different groups of studies. They look at studies in humans about if they're exposed to this virus or bacterium or chemical, is there any harmful effect? So one group is human studies. A second group is animal studies. And the third group is what's called mechanistic evidence. And what that means is that toxicologically, if we know something about, for example, the shape of the molecule and how it interacts in cells, can we say anything about how it could be likely to cause cancer, to cause metabolic disease, or some other condition? And so, in the case of IARC, of course, they're looking at specifically at could it cause cancer? Like, for example, does it damage DNA? So those three categories, human studies, animal studies, and mechanistic evidence. They gather the literature that's available on these three different areas, and then they rank each of the three different areas in three different ways: sufficient evidence, limited evidence, or inadequate evidence. In the case of aspartame, because I know this one much better, what they did was they found limited evidence for all three of those categories, for the animal studies, for the human studies, as well as for mechanistic evidence. And that was enough to give it what's called a group 2B classification, possibly carcinogenic to humans. So that's what the public hears about, and they don't necessarily know how to interpret it because they're not expected to know how IARC makes their determinations based on human studies, animal studies, and mechanistic studies. But that was what happened in the case of aspartame. Limited evidence. Oh, it's a possible carcinogen.
Yeah, well, anything's possible. But this is what drives me nuts about that. If you say it's a possible carcinogen, that means that if there's aspartame in something at a non-zero level, that means there's risk of it causing cancer. And that's how people interpret that.
That is indeed how people interpret that, because, you know, the word possible is pretty ambiguous as well.
Yeah.
It's perfectly reasonable for somebody to say, oh, that means that there's a possible risk to me from drinking this can of diet soda, when what it really means is that, well, you need to know something about the exposure part, you know, how much could cause danger. And if it's up to 20 cans of soda a day, I don't think that there's many of us around the world who are consuming 20 cans of diet soda every day. So for most of us, the risk is extremely low.
Yeah, my favorite one is going back to glyphosate,
yes,
where, you know, risk, this is a probable carcinogen.
Yes.
Again, a present very, and this is maybe an important point, is that the dose makes the poison, back to
yes.
exposure, right?
Yes.
That they'll say, well, here you have It's been detected in wine. And you see where I'm going. It's been detected at 55 parts per billion. And so this is a possible or a probable carcinogen, which that's debatable. We'll do it. Probable carcinogen at 55 parts per billion in a solution which contains 130 million parts per billion of a class one carcinogen, which is alcohol.
Exactly.
Ethanol. Yes. Which we know has specific effects on discrete etiologies in cancer. And so, and it's not just associations. I mean, these are causal connections that you can show with alcohol and colon cancer and others. And so it's amazing that someone will have a glass of wine and complain about the glyphosate within it.
That's absolutely true. And Kevin, that touches on an issue that my former thesis advisor, Dr. Baruch Fischhoff at Carnegie Mellon University, as well as Dr. Paul Slovic, and I forget the name of their organization where he works in Oregon, they did a lot of interesting work on the psychology of risk from back in the 1970s and the 1980s even, where they say, we are much more okay, so to speak, with risks where it's an activity that, or an agent that we like for some reason. And many people associate alcohol or at least moderate levels of alcohol consumption with some degree of pleasure. And so for that reason, they find the risk of liver cancer induced by alcohol or other cancers induced by alcohol as being acceptable to them. On the other hand, glyphosate isn't necessarily something that they chose.
That's right.
And that makes it, you know, much less acceptable in human mind. So even if it's, as you were talking about, 55, say, parts per billion versus, I forget, like millions.
139.
Yes, 130
13%.
Million. Yes. Even though there's absolutely no comparison in terms of risk there, the risk of alcohol and causing cancer is much, much greater. Still, that's why people fixate on the glyphosate, because there's this idea, well, it's not supposed to be there. And anyway, I'm willing to accept the risk of alcohol.
Yeah, I can choose the risk that I wish to have.
Yes.
And it's hard for scientists to understand, because I look at everything in terms of how, you know, is the glass half full or is the glass 55 parts per billion. You know, I can make that assessment, but I can understand that psychology with the average person. If it's a non-zero number or something I didn't ask for, I don't want it. And here's the other big problem is we have such good analytical chemistry that we can detect parts per trillion.
Yes.
And this has blown up big time in the media. It was in the American Academy of Pediatrics article that they're detecting a few parts per billion in urine of pregnant women, and this seems to be alarming people. But how do we communicate and interpret the idea that we can detect next to nothing?
That's a great question, Kevin, because this is a situation where, yes, indeed, our analytical chemistry techniques are getting better and better and better, which means that we can detect minute traces of just about every chemical that just a few decades ago we would say, oh, this chemical isn't in this particular food or this isn't in this particular beverage, etc. Well, in fact, it probably was there, but in trace levels that we couldn't detect until using today's chemical methods. So it's not necessarily that our environment is becoming much more filled with harmful chemicals, it's that we're much better at detecting them. And how to communicate this to the public? Yeah, that's really, really difficult, short of simply sharing the information and trusting that the public knows what to do with that information. And Kevin, if we could turn to what you had brought up in the first half, which is the whole notion of, well, if you don't use this chemical, what are you going to use in this place? I think that's a really interesting one as far as glyphosate is concerned. So for, and I think we haven't brought up with you, the audience, yet what glyphosate is. Glyphosate is a commonly used herbicide. It was first used widely in the United States in the 1970s, and it's a broad-spectrum herbicide, so if you apply it to weeds in general, it typically does a pretty good job of controlling weeds. And in 2015, IARC did their classification of glyphosate as a group 2A probable carcinogen, which I think, and I can't remember the exact classifications, but I think there was one where there was sufficient evidence and the other two where there was limited evidence, something like that. That was what it was, okay.
And even all those determinations, if you look at the data they looked at, they were considering trends in data, not even statistical significance. So statistical significance. So it was a really, really flaky determination.
I don't feel like I know their determination well enough to, I mean, or the body of studies that, on that particular analysis. What I will say is that it's not IARC's job, but I really wish that it were the job of science communicators to say, well, glyphosate may cause this particular level of hazard, but number one, what is the risk when you also take into account probable human exposures? And then also, if we didn't use glyphosate, what other kinds of herbicides would we be using instead? So my colleagues and I at Michigan State University and at Iowa State University did this study where we said, well, imagine that a farmer could not use glyphosate for some reason. What kinds of herbicides might they use instead? They might turn to atrazine or acetochlor or metallochlor. And these have, in some particular areas, significantly more risky, have greater risk profiles than glyphosate does. So we always have to be kind of keeping in the back of our mind, well, if I did not do this activity, what would I be doing instead? And doesn't that also cause potential risks or not? And if I stop using this chemical, what else would I do, for example, to control weeds in a large cornfield? Or what would I be using as a sweetener in my food? Those are the kinds of questions that we need to think about, because risk is really multifaceted in that way, which is why it's a wonderful area in which to work.
Yeah, well, then some people would say, well, you just don't use chemicals. And we're just going to have people with a hose and have people go out and do it the way we always did and get an ox to pull the cart. And, you know, that's got risk, too, because now all of a sudden you cut your yields down to nothing and you introduce a whole other set of problems with food security. So all these things have reverberations that people don't like to consider.
That's absolutely true, Kevin. And when you did mention not using chemicals at all, that reminded me of no-till agriculture versus tilling. So one of the things that farmers may do at least twice a year, for example, before they plant their seeds in the spring, say, or after they harvest their crops in the fall, is to till the fields. And one of the things that they do in those cases is to remove the crop residues, as well as to remove any potential weeds that could cause problems to the crop plants that they're growing. But, you know, tilling also comes with its own sets of risks, including the increased risk of soil erosion, the increased risk of PM2.5, particulate matter that's very small, going up into the air and lodging deep into lungs, etc. So everything we do has a risk, and I don't want you all to go about your lives terribly scared. That's no way to live, but it's simply a way to put things into perspective.
Yeah, so everything's a question of trade-offs, and looking at risk, and by the way, the thing that keeps sounding like the door opening on the Death Star behind us is they've got these giant metal doors here in the hotel, and you hear them open and close. So that's what that is. So everything's trade-offs, you know, what are risks and benefits? And to me, this has become an intriguing question, almost like a Rubik's Cube, as to how do we talk to people about risk in realistic ways? And I don't know that there is any source that I've read or seen. Jeffrey Cabot's got some good stuff on this, but how do we talk to people about this to get them to understand it better? I mean, is there anybody out there who seems to really frame this well and how we can possibly break through to the folks who are so nervous about the science around us?
Well, Kevin, that's a great question, and I am more than happy to recommend so many of my colleagues in the area of risk communication. So another hat that I wear is that currently I am the president of the Society for Risk Analysis, which is an international organization with thousands of members worldwide. And one of our specialty groups is specifically in risk communication. So there are people working in academia, in industry, in government, in non-governmental organizations who focus specifically on the best ways that we can communicate risk, particularly if we understand first about people's risk perceptions and their attitudes and their behaviors and their practices. There are whole disciplines devoted to this area that it's really, really important to understand first how people perceive risk, and that's a way that we can begin to communicate it in a way that they might be able to better understand the risk, maybe more comfortable with it, or maybe able to make better decisions as a result. So if for some reason somebody was really worried about the types of sweeteners that they used, hopefully we would find the appropriate way to communicate about all the different possibilities so they can say, okay, this is how I choose to deal with it.
Well, that's a really good note to go out on. I think it's really kind of my next frontier in terms of thinking. I'm going to start studying risk and risk communication because that's where I'm at. You know, we have all the evidence. We have all the facts. And we're not compelling when we communicate them often. Getting better all the time. But I think especially around questions of risk, I really want relative risk. I really want to be able to do that better. So connect me with your sources.
I would be very happy to do so. I have many friends and colleagues in risk communication all over the U.S. and world. So,
well, Dr. Felicia Wu, thank you very much for joining me again. It's always a pleasure to see you and to talk to you about these things. I walk away from the table a little smarter every time. So thank you.
That's very kind of you, Dr. Falk. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And for everybody else, thank you very much for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Tell a friend, share on social media, help us find a few more people, and check out the video stream of this, which is present on several of our episodes. Not this one, unfortunately, but we're doing video on every other episode. So thank you for checking that out on YouTube. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast by Collabra. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Talking Biotech, sponsored by Collabra, the platform that bridges the gap between siloed research tools. With Collabra's electronic lab notebook, scientists can work together in real time, sharing data and insights with ease. Revolutionize your research collaboration. Sign up for a demo today at collabra.app, collabra.app.